I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, we're talking about mental health. It's a broad phrase, we know. And to struggle with mental health could mean anything from feeling lonely at home to being deeply anxious, depressed, or even suicidal. A recent University of Vermont study found nearly half of respondents in Vermont and Maine experienced anxiety or depression during the pandemic. It also found an increase in people turning to substances like drugs and alcohol. And other people who normally took medicine to treat depression or anxiety were lapsing on those prescriptions. So today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk with mental health professionals about the scope of this crisis and hear how they're handling the spike in demand for their services. Then we'll talk about how it's affecting children and schools specifically. And at the end of the show, we want to make sure that we leave you with some suggestions for how to support your own mental health day to day. We're joined today by Dr. Andrew Rosenfeld, a child psychiatrist and assistant professor at UVM Larner School of Medicine. Dr. Rosenfeld, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined today by Kath Burns, a psychologist and quality director at Vermont Care Partners and a clinical coordinator at COVID Support VT. Welcome, Kath.
Thanks for having me today.
Now, before we get started, I want to note that if you or a loved one is in serious emotional distress, you can always call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 800-273-8255. And we also have some resources online at vpr.org where you can find crisis lines for veterans, for LGBTQ plus listeners, and crisis text lines. That's all at vpr.org when you click Vermont Edition. Now, Andy, let's start by unpacking this phrase, mental health. We hear it more and more often these days. What exactly do we mean when we say mental health?
That is a wonderful and complicated question. I think that our fields of psychiatry, psychology, social work, and other sort of standard mental health practitioners often have a focus or emphasis on symptoms and mental illness. And so mental health becomes the alleviation of those symptoms and mental illness, so feeling not depressed or not anxious. But we sometimes miss the other half of it, which is how to thrive and flourish in life and what a true picture of well-being would be like once we get beyond not being stuck in anger or depression or anxiety or other difficult emotions. So it's an evolving question, but most of our healthcare system is set up to focus on mental illness, so diagnosable conditions like major depression or an anxiety disorder, OCD or ADHD, trauma-related disorders, etc. I think being able to look at what mental health would be and how to measure that is really, over the past couple of decades, emerging in the mental health fields as more of a target rather than a symptom focus or illness focused approach. So we have a lot of programs in Vermont and around the country that are moving towards strengths-based, family-based, community-based approaches that look at mental health as sort of a combination of a low amount of symptoms that may fluctuate, but also a high amount of engagement in meaningful activities, connection to positive relationships, experience of positive emotions and competence in some areas, being able to feel good about the way you can do things. So that combination of elements, I would say, sort of represents mental health.
Okay, so it can be both symptoms and a way of approaching wellness and approaching feeling better, feeling more connected to the world.
Yes.
And Kath, how would you describe this phrase mental health and the way that we use it in society today? I feel like as Andy was saying, sometimes it can be a catch-all term for a very broad series of symptoms or feelings, and other times it's a way of talking about wellness and self-care. How do you define it?
I think what I would add to what Andy offered is that it is a balance between being aware of what types of experiences you're having, if you are experiencing anxiety, depression, or other symptoms, and with your ability to balance your coping and wellness. And I think we would say broadly that someone who is experiencing mental health is someone who's able to experience those feelings, which are normal and common, and are able to balance them with good coping and healthy habits.
Andy and Kathy, I want to hear from you, for both of you on this question, because I know that there has been such an influx of need over the course of the pandemic, to the point that we hear a lot these days about the mental health crisis. So Andy, first to you, what is the scope of that crisis? Like, how has your job changed over the past two, nearly 3 years?
Sure. I think that it's been in a number of ways. I think that I really appreciate what Kath added in terms of bringing awareness to our emotions and our state of well-being. I think the pandemic has had so many challenges. One piece of it is that there's been more awareness of suffering and loss and uncertainty and how that affects our stress levels. So that's contributed to a greater desire and need for mental health supports. So we're seeing simply an expansion in numbers. That is, our current system was already underprepared, was not meeting the needs of everyone who deserved mental health care and supports, broadly defined. The pandemic has amplified the numbers of people who are recognizing I could benefit from such things as therapy or case management or psychiatric services, and even on the more intense side, hospitalization-based programs. But we have had only a reduction in the availability of those services based on people changing jobs and leaving jobs, based on inpatient and hospital beds being closed for a variety of reasons, some related to the pandemic and some less so. So we have that problem that there are more people recognizing mental health needs. And on top of that, there's been the amplification because the pandemic, broadly speaking, all the things rolled into that has brought so much stress to everyone's lives. So there is a lot more anxiety, depression, substance use problems, suicide-related problems, etc. Almost anyone with a mental health problem going into the pandemic experienced an exacerbation or a worsening of symptoms. It's not true totally across the board, and I think, of course, there are fluctuations in the day-to-day. So the other piece beyond the increase in numbers and decrease in services is that the intensity So a lot of my work is in a psychiatry clinic for kids and families at the University of Vermont, and the intensity of symptoms and distress has gone up in the kids who we see in that clinic at the same time that the wait list has grown, so more families seeking care. So it's been pretty hard, I think, for families to have a match there in terms of getting their needs met in a timely fashion, and the needs are more severe across the board.
And I want to get back to that in just a moment, this problem of, you know, there being more need than there are providers available to help. But first, Kath, I'd love to hear from you on this. How have you seen needs change over the course of the pandemic, over these last nearly 3 years?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a really interesting one, and I think I'm going to answer it from the perspective of two different hats. So first of all, you know, all providers, everyone, all of us are experiencing this same pandemic. So in the sense, I think that's really affected all of our awareness of how acute things can feel, if that makes sense. So absolutely an increase in anxiety and depression. If you had a pre-existing condition of any kind, it was likely exacerbated by the isolation and fear that's and the ambiguity of the pandemic. But what I think is also interesting is I've seen in the Vermont Care Partner Network, this network of 16 agencies around our state that support people with mental health conditions and substance use disorders and intellectual and developmental disabilities. While I've seen the demand go up, what I've learned is just the amazing creativity and innovation they've tried to approach this problem with, to try to meet and find people who were really instantly isolated by the pandemic. And then in my work with COVID Support BT, that is completely a wellness and coping focused project. And so what I've noticed is just by nature of what that project is, people's willingness to come to the different workshops or talk to our counselors, and then being willing to just not just talk about what's going on with them, but then trying to pivot to figure out how to cope with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you also clarify for us what the Vermont Care Partners Network does? How does that program work?
Yeah, I can. Thank you for asking. So Vermont Care Partners is a network of these 16 agencies around the state that everybody has one in their community. And they have buildings everywhere, but you don't often know that they're there because by definition, we're trying to be discreet and protect people's privacy while we support them to live full lives if they're also living with a mental health condition or substance use disorder or disability. And the agencies provided all kinds of clinical services and supports and emergency services to over 36,000 people last year. And so there's people working in your communities right now, helping people to live full lives. And we have a higher rate in Vermont of just our ability to reach people with conditions, which sounds so counterintuitive to what we know, given what we're hearing about wait lists. But Vermont really has put a huge emphasis on supporting people in their communities rather than developing institutions. And as a result, sometimes the facilities are, we don't know what they are because we're purposely trying to embed them in communities.
And where can people go to learn more about the workshops and the other services that the Vermont Care Partners Network provides?
Sure. So you can learn about the Vermont Care Partner Network by going to our website, vermontcarepartners.org. In terms of support wellness programs through COVID Support VT, that's a separate website called covidsupportvt.org. And I'm guessing probably people can reach out to you all to get the specific address.
Yes, they can. And we'll put those in our show notes as well.
Awesome. COVID Support VT is offering a whole variety of wellness and coping workshops almost daily. And you can also call 211 and select option 2 and reach a COVID support counselor between 8 and 6 Monday through Friday. And they're there to help provide support, coping, wellness, and then referrals to community-based programs that could be helpful.
Now, Andy, for someone seeking help, it can be really confusing to see all the different types of mental health professionals out there, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, therapists. How can people know which type of help is right for them?
Yeah, it's an important question, and it definitely is a confusing system. I think I often recommend that folks connect with their primary care providers as a starting point, because we're really lucky the network of pediatricians and family doctors and internists in Vermont is very skilled, and so they often have a lot of knowledge and ability to address mental health problems, but they also have longitudinal relationships with the patients and families they work with, so they know the communities well, they know the patients well, they know the resources well. So that makes them sort of a good clearinghouse to direct people in terms of how the primary care provider might assess the problem and connect them to what different to the Vermont Care Partner agencies or whatever local resources are available. And I would just say a word about there's a lot of overlap in the even in the licensing and degrees that you described. The psychiatrists come from a very medical perspective, so to become a psychiatrist after college requires 4 years of a medical school that could lead to either an MD or a DO degree, osteopathic or allopathic. And then in psychiatry, there's a 4-year general residency to train to treat mostly adults. So there's some pediatric training, and then some go on to specialize in different areas. Child psychiatry requires an additional 2-year fellowship. And that practice is broadly trained in medical models and different systems, rotating not just through psychiatry, but obstetrics and surgery and internal medicine, and ends up bringing that expertise to a role that can evaluate mental health disorders, diagnose, make treatment plans, carry out therapies, evidence-based therapies, prescribe medications, recommend interventions like ECT and others. A psychology provider, I'm sure Kath can provide more details, is a different path, often is also a doctoral degree that comes with different letters, PhDs or PsyDs. There are master's level psychologists as well, and they tend to focus on clinical work, research work, or both, and get training in both, and then do an internship. So that's often as well a long training program, and then psychologists can do also therapy, assessment, diagnosis, evaluation, treatment planning. Psychologists are sometimes trained to do diagnostic, like pencil and paper, psychological assessments or IQ assessments or computerized assessments or personality, those sorts of things. They specialize, and they could end up working in schools, having private practices, working in hospitals. Then you've got social workers, which is a master's level degree and trained in a very systemic approach, looking at families and systems and communities and how to meet all of the psychosocial needs of families. They also can end up providing therapy services and doing mental health evaluation. So some overlap there.
It's a lot of information. Yeah, it's a lot.
It is. It's a ton. A lot. And there's more.
And I can imagine that, you know, for somebody who is, you know, perhaps seeking help for the first time, it can feel very overwhelming. So what's your suggestion for somebody who, you know, is at the very beginning of this process and says, hey, I just need to do a Google search and I need to find somebody who I can try to talk to about what's going on? What's step number one for a person in those shoes?
Well, I think there's also the overlay of paying for that treatment.
Right.
So we have this very complicated insurance system, and some people don't have insurance, and then there's Medicaid and Medicare and all the private insurances. So that's an overlay too of I might find the right treatment, but then how will I afford it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think for that reason, I think primary care providers are really tuned into this network. I think the website that Kath provided about the Vermont care agencies, they also know and sometimes are or house the local resources that span these areas, psychiatry, social work, psychology. So I think those are really good starting points. We often send people to websites like Psychology Today because various stripes of therapists will list their profiles there. I find that kind of daunting in the way you said, how am I supposed to distinguish who would be right for me? But it does give information about what they do and what insurance they accept. So those would be some starting points.
And I'm happy to say that I have been on Psychology Today to look for a therapist, and it can feel a little bit like online dating in a way. You get a photo and a little profile and a description, and it's hard to know, how to connect with somebody, especially in that, you know, kind of disconnected online sort of way. Kath, do you have any suggestions here, first steps for folks?
I do, and my first statement about this is, right now, everybody, all of us are under a lot of stress, and there, I think a lot of people think, oh no, I feel anxious, I need a therapist right away. And that may or may not be true. And I'm not trying to diminish the importance of clinical work because I'm also a clinician, but I think it's okay to take a beat and think for a moment, okay, what do I think I'm needing? Do I need support? Am I lonely? Am I looking for companionship? Do I need skills? Do I not know? So I think it's okay to take a moment and think that through, because there might be other ways to get support that could help. So I think, you know, one thing to do is to reach out to people that you trust, like friends, family members who you trust, and talk about what's going on for you. And you might find some clarity about what you're needing. I think some people are involved in faith-based communities, and a lot of those leaders can be incredibly helpful in terms of providing support. And for kids, a lot of them really are helped by meaningful adults in their lives, like teachers and coaches or adult friends of the family. And that can really make a big difference. And then I think also a word about stigma. I think a lot of people have been really hesitant to say, I've been feeling anxious or depressed or overwhelmed because of the negative connotation that has historically been carried by those experiences. And I guess if I had to pick an upside to this pandemic, which seems ridiculous to state, is that the experience of anxiety and depression has become so common that it's actually more normal to talk about these things. So I guess talk about it with people you trust to understand better what you think you're looking for. And that might also help drive where you find that support.
Right. And Kath, I want to thank you for bringing up that notion of stigma. And I think that, in all transparency, it's evidenced by, you know, the fact that, on a show where we usually get a lot of calls in, today we're not getting very many. And I understand that. I think it's still a difficult conversation to have, either, you know, amongst your family, maybe with a child who's suffering, or even with your friends or your larger community, to stop and say, hey, yes, I need some help.
I think that's true. And to offer one other quick thought, you know, there's been some broad polling done around the country to understand people's experience. And there was one done by the Kaiser Family Foundation. I want to get the number right, where they basically 80% of respondents said this has been the most stressful time in their life. So how can this not be a normal experience?
Now, many of the experts that we spoke with before this show said that social anxiety and depression were already prevalent among kids even before the pandemic. And some attributed it to the dehumanizing effect of social media, others to stressful family situations, and COVID has made many of those situations worse. Andy, what are some of the behaviors that you've seen in your young patients that you attribute to the pandemic?
Well, I think it's mixed. I think that there have been sort of phases of the pandemic, and there was some relief for a portion of people who were dealing with versions of social anxiety or other types of anxiety when they got to stay at home and had a little less social contact, sometimes because anxiety and avoidance go hand in hand. So it allowed a lot of avoidance. So I think that some people's the symptoms or sequelae that come from that anxiety improved as there was more things remote and more opportunity to distance. On the other hand, I think for folks who were already suffering by being withdrawn, isolated, or lonely and the consequences of that, it's made things so much harder. Over time, as this has worn on and become the current state of things, I think it's been difficult for everybody because there's been strain economically and in terms of health and more anxiety about what COVID will do to families. And there's been a lot of political and social justice distress. And so I think at some turning point, the unpredictability of whether I'm going to be in person in school or at home remote and all the other variants of that for parents, for kids, for teachers across the board has kind of raised stress levels. It's led to a lot of technological connection, right. And that also splits. I think that's been a lifesaver for some kids and groups. I mean, if I'm excluded or having trouble fitting in, online is often a way to find inclusion and more community. If I'm not able to access mental health services, there's been a telehealth revolution spurred by the pandemic. So that's allowed us to connect with people in different ways and times. But at the same time, there's so much possibility of being bullied or left out online or mistreated in other ways, or spending all one's time scrolling about negative things or comparing to people's Instagram beautiful pictures and feeling bad about oneself. And
right. So, I mean, I certainly struggle with that myself as an adult. It's hard to find that line between using social media as a way to connect and recognizing when it becomes the exact opposite. Let's go now to the phones. Leslie in Burlington is calling in. Leslie, thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
I was just going to say, and thank you, I think having these discussions and even the acknowledgement, because I think, you know, we all entered 2021 thinking, okay, you know, we've got vaccines, and it's still tough. And you know, people are, it's sometimes it's hard to even say, it's still tough. Mm-hmm. And having these conversations and being able to talk about it and having, whether it be a mental health counselor, is critical, but even just being able to acknowledge that is really helpful and I think may be important for people. So thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in, Leslie. I appreciate that and for being part of this conversation. I'd like to bring in one more voice now. Tom Murphy is the co-founder of Sweethearts and Heroes, which is a St. Albans-based program that works with kids in schools to build empathy and counter bullying. And he's really been able to see a lot of these mental health challenges firsthand. Tom, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks so much. Great to be here.
Now, from what you've learned talking with kids over the past months and years, what do you think is the biggest factor that's affecting children's mental health right now?
Well, you know, it's crazy. You're not going to believe this. Well, I'm sitting in my old principal's office and Cooperstown High School right now. I've only been in this building one time since graduation, and I've got these amazing memories flooding back because I was a real challenge for educators growing up. Just was that kid that couldn't sit still. But, you know, all of the people that are speaking so far are just dead on that anxiety, fear is the number one thing that young people face today. It's now replaced depression. But other things like empathy have been nearly cut in half in the last 30 years. And as I sit in this school and I think back to the young people that weren't treated the right way 25, 30 years ago when I was in school, that kid today that is just riddled with anxiety and fear because of everything that's going on in our world today, he or she really has about half the chance of receiving empathy from his or her peer. And really, that's all that young people want. You know, they're on this deep search for the elements or the beginning of the meaning in their life. But they're also, like, deeply wanting human acceptance and connection. And
So, Tom, I'm curious how you kind of teach them to connect with each other in that way, because it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, that children oftentimes do need help and support from mental health professionals, but they can also get support from one another, from their peers. How do you teach that?
Well, you know, I say that, you know, these soft skills that people call them, I call them human skills, have been on a fast decline as well. You know, we don't spend time around the kitchen table anymore. We don't spend time in the garage working on a car with dad or grandpa. Our kids just don't have that connection that they used to have, you know, 30 years ago. And so like Leslie said, I truly believe it starts with conversations. And we spend a lot of time in circle with young people having these conversations. You know, a really good friend of mine, his first district as a counselor, they had 15 suicides in 30 months. And his name is Tim McGowan. He went and built Wingman Connect for the U.S. Air Force around these kinds of things. And if Tim were on this call, he would say exactly what Leslie said. It's about having conversations. It's about starting that discussion, because we're not doing that. In this great world of mass distraction, we're not just beginning the conversation. So it really starts with that. But then I would tell you, you know, I've probably spoken to over 100 principals in the last 18 months. And if I said to them, what's the most important thing? They would say, oh, the social emotional health of our children. And I say, okay, well, what are you doing about that? And they say, well, we're going to bring a speaker in, and, you know, we have a program the kids can use. And I like to say, well, you should try that with math sometime. You know, just have a program that they can use and bring in one lesson and say, good luck, I'll see you at the test. And to answer your question, what we do is we practice some of these social emotional skills that kids used to do just naturally in self-directed, self-controlled play. They used to do it naturally around the dinner table, in the barn, all these other places. So for me, you know, it's a lot of circle work that we do around, you know, connection and conversations, but it's also practicing these skills like any other skill that kids practice in school.
And I want to jump in here because we actually have on the line as a caller, Matt Barry, who's a principal at Peru High School, I believe has worked with you in the past. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
Now you've mentioned to our producer on a call that you think many kids were already having mental health challenges before COVID and that they've gotten worse. They've just gotten worse. Can you explain what you think is contributing to it for the students that you work with at Peru High?
Yes. I when talking to the producer yesterday, I was appreciative of how she frame the question of the mental health issues that our students are facing have been exacerbated due to the pandemic. They were there before, as Tom previously mentioned, the reduction in empathy over the last 30 years. And I think what that pandemic has done and what we're facing is students were put into a place where they were even more forced to abandon human interaction. We were locked up into places to create, to stop the spread of a virus. But that at the same time, that increased screen time, it increased time alone, it increased less interactions with students. And, you know, I listened to the other professionals who were on and talked about the increase in fear and anxiety. And that's what we hear a lot from our kids. They're fearful, and they will admit to you they're having a hard time handling the situations they're faced with right now.
And you also said you recently saw 6 students admitted for mental health breakdowns in about a week's time. That's a pretty shocking number. Can you tell us about that and talk a little bit about what you think led to that particular bad week? Was there something going on, or is it just part of those larger, longer crisis?
I think it's part of the larger crisis, but I would also echo some of the sentiment of the earlier professionals, the students did seek help, which I thought was really important in that. And I wanted to point that out, that part of my experience there is either the student sought help, a parent got involved, and in a couple of cases, which was really refreshing because it speaks to the programming we worked with Tom, their peers made an adult aware, and we were able to intervene. That was a bad time. I actually gave Tom a call, and we talked a lot about it. Sorry, that's my bell releasing our kids to the next class. So we actually talked a lot about that, and it was a downtime, but I can tell you that we're in a better place with those situations.
Well, Principal Matt Berry, we'll let you get back to your kids at Peru High School. Thank you so much for calling in. Let's go now Xenia in Barrie. Xenia, you're on the air. Go ahead. And I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yeah, you have it right. I'm in my 70s now and retired and disabled. And right now I also have COVID.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I did the mental health thing as a client, the whole range of outpatient and inpatient and being beaten by staff in the state hospital and so on. But I also discovered peer support. There are a lot of peer support groups around the state, and those can be found. And there's even one place where people who don't want to take drugs can go, the Alyssum program in Rochester. Mm. I tried the drug route, but it didn't work, and it kind of damped me down, so I was kind of like a sedated drug zombie for 14 years.
Mm.
And it also ruined my teeth, because a lot of those drugs give you dry mouth syndrome, which...
Xenia, thank you so much for calling in, and I'm so glad that you were able to find those support groups to help you. Now, Tom, before we let you go, speaking of the support groups that Xenia was able to find for older adults, for you, do you feel like there are enough places outside of schools that kids could go and connect and talk about mental health, or is in school services really, you know, the best place to have these conversations?
Well, certainly there's lots of places online, and kids can tell you where to go for help because they're just so good at navigating this brave new world, to steal from Aldous Huxley, that we all live in. But, you know, our message and what Matt has supported, we actually run a class over at Peru. It's our Braves class. And it's a self-directed, self-controlled leadership class. They have some instructors that go through our curriculum. But really, our message from day one has been the same, that, you know, 96 to 97% of the time, the negative behavior that young people face is never seen by adults. Yet 85% of the time, there's other students there watching. And from day one, our message has never been, you know, let's give some support to those kids that are marginalized, that are in trouble, that are treated the wrong way. Our message has always been about empowering the other students that see those things happening. So when Matt says that, it just really encourages me. And I just talked to another teacher in Central New York yesterday on my drive back from a school in Pennsylvania. And she called me up, and we wrote a great book called The 13 Pillows for Affective Teachers. And she's reading it to her students. And one of them is called Wilting Flowers, and it's just never walk by a wilting flower. And, you know, you got to sprinkle it with some acceptance, with some significance or meaning, and help it grow. And it was so great because these are eighth graders. They're walking through the hall. They see this fifth grade little boy sitting against the wall after reading this chapter, being read it. And they stop, and he's crying, and he's afraid to go home because he got in trouble. And, you know, he said his dad beats him. And he has no support, and he's not going to find it online, may or may not find it in the school. But how we have these eighth grade young people that find him, take him down to the counselor, beg to stay with him. And that's the answer. Our children are the ones that are on the front line of this pandemic of hopelessness. And make no mistake about it, that's one of the pandemics that we're truly in. You know, we have, since 2007, suicides in 10 to 14-year-olds have tripled. And that's maybe the worst of the destructive decisions.
Well, Tom, I'm going to have to jump in here because we're going to have to take a quick break. Tom Murphy is the co-founder of Sweethearts and Heroes. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. This hour, we're talking all about the mental health crisis. We're speaking with Dr. Andrew Rosenfeld, a child psychiatrist, and Kathy Burns, a psychologist. Welcome back to the show. Now, in these last 15 minutes, I want to make sure that we leave our listeners with some tools for what they can do to support their own mental health day to day. And Kath, I know you have a lot of tips there. What are some suggestions that you have for folks who just want to, you know, take small steps to start feeling better?
Sure. Thank you for that. And this is a big part of the COVID Support BT program, is really helping people get back on track on taking care of their own wellness as best as they can. And I think the best place to start is to make a plan for how to approach and maintain their own wellness. And people can go to COVID Support BT and download an actual plan that you can fill out and put on your fridge to remind you to try to take care of yourself. And as I go through this list, I want to say that on my days when I'm feeling more stressed, I think to myself, these things don't work. But the reality is I'd be in a much worse place if I didn't try to do these things. So to quickly go through a list, one is to try to do something you like every day, even if it's brief. So if you like to read, if you like to cook, if you like to run, something, do something you enjoy every day just for a little bit of time. Try to do one thing from start to finish every day. Email does not count. So maybe it's something simple like making your bed or brushing your teeth. You need to let yourself experience completion. And because so many of us are walking around feeling like we're never going to get everything done. Mm. The third thing is to make sure you find a way to connect with people regularly. You can do it through text, phone, email, letters over the fence, whatever that is for you. But this pandemic really has been, has just decimated our ability to connect with one another. So that's critical. Another one is to get some exercise, whatever that is for you. You know, we want people to get their heart rate up for reasons other than being stressed out. So maybe you walk, maybe you take a class, maybe you do chair yoga, whatever that is for you. It's really important to move your body because that directly decreases people's experiences of depression and anxiety. And three more quick ones. One is to really try hard to have good sleep hygiene. Try to sleep on a schedule. Try not to use electronics before bedtime. Try not to use alcohol or caffeine before bed. The next is to try to eat well. You certainly manage stress better if your body has the fuel to do so. And then finally, the last one is to, and this is a hard one, but to try to find ways to notice what you're grateful for throughout your day and to try to be mindful throughout your day to allow your mind to stop. So if it's a long list, so maybe that's overwhelming in and of itself. So maybe pick one and try that and see if it helps just bring your stress down a little bit. But it can make a huge difference for people who have tried it.
And thanks so much for that list, Kath. We'll be sure to link to those types of resources in our show notes on vpr.org as well if our listeners want to refer back and try a couple of those tips. Let's go now to Freda in East Montpelier. Freda, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First of all, before I say anything else, I just want to echo everything that Tom Murphy said. I mean, you know, if there's one thing we as pediatricians could change, it's getting kids more connected to each other rather than connecting online with social media. There are programs like ReTribe. There are Youth Service Bureau programs that get kids together. And having kids hear each other's experiences is just so, so important. And it's important in environments with supportive adults. I just can't emphasize that enough. But as a pediatrician, you know, from the perspective of being a PCP, I do want to make a comment about Dr. Andy's comment for folks connecting to their PCPs. You know, for one, there are so many Vermonters who don't have a PCP, and access to getting connected with a new PCP is sometimes a struggle these days for folks in terms of wait lists, transportation issues in rural areas, etc. So that's something that really has to be recognized. And then when folks do connect with their PCPs, and again, I can only speak from a pediatrician's perspective, sometimes we ourselves are so frustrated because we want to connect kids to psychologists, to therapists, to psychiatrists if we feel like we need them. And there are 3, 4, 5, even 6 month wait lists for some of these things. Kids who need inpatient treatment have incredibly long wait lists. And so we need to recognize that there is so much work that needs to be done from an advocacy level, from a legislative level, to really, really improve access to all types of care, training more skilled mental health workers. We really need to work with the powers that be to really advocate for kids having better access to care in the state of Vermont, because right now it's really dismal. So yes, PCPs can recommend what sort of care your child needs in terms of what direction to take, but the reality of being able to access that level of care is just not always feasible. And then lastly, I want to say, I cannot emphasize enough how much we are in a mental health epidemic for kids. I sometimes have days, and I have now worked in 3 different pediatric settings in the state of Vermont, and there are sometimes days where literally half of our patient load each day in the outpatient arena is taken up by seeing nothing but mental health. Mm. I've been a pediatrician since 1994. I have never experienced anything like this anywhere I have worked until...
Freda, thank you so much for sharing the scope of this issue. And Andy, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to what she was saying about the difficulty in finding PCPs or pediatricians even to kind of start this process of getting your kid connected to a mental health professional. And specifically, what would you like to ask of lawmakers or state officials who may be in a position to improve access to mental health care for children specifically?
Thanks. I appreciate Frida's comments as well. I really want to echo them. The state of crisis feels unprecedented. In terms of pediatric mental health, it's probably not very different in terms of general and adult mental health. I think that all of what she said makes a lot of sense. I think that hiring and training more supportive resources across the board, and that includes programs like TOMS in schools and to incorporate peer services that Zinnia mentioned earlier, as well as the traditional sort of more mental health medical model providers and supporting primary care practices. I think there's a real lack of integration. So some practices might have embedded mental health supports where if a pediatrician is seeing kids with mental health challenges or needs, they might be able to connect them on the spot, but most don't. And that's assuming, as Freda mentioned, that kids can get in to see or have a PCP or primary care doctor. So I think the other piece of it that I would advocate for, besides expanding the workforce and compensating them well and training them in evidence-based models, is how we look after the caregivers. I think part of what has been different in the pandemic is, like, pandemic means all the people, everybody in the demographic, mm-hmm. and that's unusual to have a whole system suffering. It's as if you're in a family with 4 or 5 people, and it's not just one person who's ill, everybody's ill, and that happens with COVID, but that's also happening with this mental health strain where when you could rely on the healthier or more balanced or less stressed family members to take care of the others, that's often not the case. Now the whole family is struggling with these problems, and that's true of the broader families and communities. So at schools, the teachers are overwhelmed by taking care of their own family's needs, by financial stresses, et cetera, by illness and COVID. The parents and caregivers at home are overwhelmed in those ways. So I think we need to think about a broader system that doesn't look at a child as an individual, but looks at families and local systems and how, because we have very good science to show that anything we do for the caregivers and teachers that are living with and seeing these kids day to day to improve the mental health and well-being of the caregivers and teachers and other community providers is going to help the kids directly and indirectly. So I think we would be remiss not to include that in our planning.
Right. And it can feel very overwhelming, which is why I'm glad, Kath, you were also able to share those tips for how families and individuals can kind of work on their own mental health in small ways every day. Let's go now to Lucy in Marshfield. And Lucy, we're so glad you called in. We only have about a minute or two left, but what is your question or comment?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay, great. My go-to sanity maintenance tool for years now, pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, hopefully post-pandemic, is The Work. It's called The Work of Byron Katie, K-A-T-I-E.
Mm-hmm.
She had a book called Loving What Is. She has a podcast. Just go to At Home with Byron Katie on all the social media. The website is thework.com. It's a very simple yet powerful way to deal with any stressful thought under the sun. And that's my first thing. And besides that, I do yoga. I do sometimes silent sitting, mindfulness. I go talk to a counselor sometimes. And all the things that the lady mentioned, some of the things, the diet, the exercise. But for me personally, the main thing, somehow, I just love The Work. It's just been such a blessing in my life.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Lucy. And Kath, briefly, what's your response to that concept of loving the work, of working on yourself?
Well, I think it's an important thing to do, and it's the one thing you have control over right now, which is how you manage yourself day to day. And I think it's really important to note that some of us are in a place of privilege where we're able to do some of these things more.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a whole other very lengthy and very important conversation, but you can only start with yourself, and then you can model it for your kids.
Well, Kath Burns, thank you so much for joining Vermont Edition. Kath is a licensed psychologist doctorate at Vermont Care Partners. And a note for listeners, COVID Support VT, which Kath works with, is a VPR underwriter. Dr. Andy Rosenfeld is a child psychiatrist and assistant professor at UVM Larner School College of Medicine. And thank you to everyone who called in and shared their stories this hour. Now, if you are thinking about suicide or are worried about a friend or a loved one or like emotional support, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Network is available 24/7 across the U.S. And that number is 1-800-273-8255.